Well, thank you very much, and good afternoon. And I wanted to also, again, offer my thanks to Terry for helping put together this panel. She's always been a very active sponsor of making sure that the APHA is kept updated on the IOM's work. So I'm just curious, this is my last day at the conference. I'm actually heading on to another meeting tomorrow. How many of you, is this your first APHA meeting? Okay. Because I have to tell you, I'm just going through these observations in my head. There's a lot of people at this conference, right? And then secondly, I was like, 20% of the people have these badges to say they're presenters. That's why there's so many people here. And then on the last thought I had, you know, the food is not that healthy at this conference, right? So just share some observations with you. But 13,000 people. Wow. Wow. And that is amazing. That is a small city. Takes a village. But I do want to also tell you that as I'm going to share some thoughts with you, I wear several hats, and many of the thoughts and reflections I have with you with regards to equity and the Affordable Care Act not only were inspired by our two next speakers, but also because I wear several hats. In addition, I'm being on the roundtable around health disparities and equity. I'm also on the IOM roundtable on health literacy, which you'll see later figured into some of the work that I've been doing with some colleagues at the IOM as well. And then also I have to mention, too, that I'm on a CMS committee on advising the administrator on outreach and education to communities. Interesting stories there. So I can't separate all these reflections from the different hats that I wear. So let me just go through some of the slides. You know, have you heard anything about the Affordable Care Act in the last couple of weeks? It's not been in the news very much, has it? Obviously, facetious statement. I think if you just look on MSNBC or Fox News, some of you see Fox News, it's like the lead story every night now. I think it's worthy to recall, as much as the bumps and bruises and warts of the Affordable Care Act, that we remind ourselves that the origins of the Affordable Care Act were actually not an ideal situation. And if you think about this, when Scott Brown was elected to replace Senator Kennedy out of Massachusetts, there were many people across the country that said that health care reform was dead because there was not a supermajority in the Senate. So Congress actually had to go autonomously to put forward legislation. And that legislation was actually only put forward because Anthem out in California had raised their individual rates by up to 50% to 60%, which caused a big uproar. So I think it's really important to recognize, as much as there is some kind of confounding opinions with regards to the Affordable Care Act, the political process just took place the way it did. It gave birth to the Tea Party, which I think, you know, as we reflect maybe 20 years from now, might have been one of the most significant political occurrences in our recent history. And Nancy Pelosi, who was the majority leader, basically lost her majority seat because of her championing the Affordable Care Act. So many things that sometimes we get lost into all these details about, you know, whether the technology glitch was whose fault, et cetera. We have short memories in the United States with regards to how things really happen here. So just also in terms of the impact of the Affordable Care Act, as the bar graph shows, it is disproportionately impacting communities of color, i.e. disproportionate opportunity for communities of color to be benefiting from the Affordable Care Act. Now, when you look at how it takes in real life, and this is where we start to catch up with the most recent happenings, we had this great idea that Affordable Care Act would be able to roll out and get access for up to 37 million Americans. That promise still is there, but we also have to recognize that every individual has a different story in terms of how they're going to find their journey to get access to care. And these are just some scenarios. Consider yourself as Reggie, who is 55 years old, he's married, he may have to be facing a penalty if he doesn't buy insurance under the marketplace. And then Selena, she may be able to go into the marketplace because her income is below 400% of the federal poverty level, she might be able to get a subsidy. And then you have Ashley here, who now does find herself Medicaid eligible. So the complexity, these are just three scenarios. As we have found out, there are at least 100 different scenarios. And when you take in consideration that people come in units of families, certain individuals within a family might qualify for subsidy, some might not qualify for subsidy, some may be more qualified for Medicaid, some may not even qualify to purchase on the marketplace. Our families have a mixture of units or individuals within every family unit that have different pathways in terms of gaining coverage. So the complexity of how we put this together is certainly a challenge as we think about the slide previously, this the bar graph of the disproportionate opportunity that the Affordable Care Act is, that there's hundreds of different situations in which people are going to find coverage through the Affordable Care Act. Now, this is a clipping that I actually took from the New York Times about 2.5 years ago. So this was before any of this stuff happened. And when I looked at this, I said, this is an interesting thing because it's trying to break down how people are actually going to get coverage through the federal government. And when I looked at this, and you can see, and I know you don't need to read all the details, of course, but as individual seeks coverage under the state health insurance exchange, there's a lot of filtering with regards to going into whether you meet criteria for Medicaid, whether you meet criteria for a subsidy, whether there's a communication between the Social Security Administration, Homeland Security, et cetera, and then finally outcomes this opportunity where the magic box, the algorithm, tells you what you're eligible for. This was the graphic that was displayed 2.5 years ago, right? So even when I looked at this, I said, this is pretty complicated. Now, on top of that, what happened? What happened since 2.5 years ago? Because of whatever happened in the Supreme Court, we have a Balkan way of doing this now because certain states certainly are not joining into the Medicaid expansion. Certain states say, you set it up because we don't want to have anything to do with the marketplace. So we have a quilt of states, some of which have Medicaid expansion, some do not have Medicaid expansion, some that have a state-based marketplace, some that said the federal government can set it up. So we have complicated the scenario for Reggie 100 times over because of these different situations. But that's what we have to deal with. Now, we actually have used this particular graphic within Kaiser Permanente because Kaiser Permanente is a health plan. We provide health care to 9.2 million members across the country. And when we started to look at the scenario, you can understand that in the previous situation, people were basically uninsured or insured by commercial insurance, either through their employers or maybe they had their own business and bought into some health plan, or they would fall into Medicaid and or their children would have coverage under the Children's Health Insurance Plan. And if, of course, you're 65 and over, you would qualify for Medicare if you were meet the criteria. It was relatively simple back then, wasn't it? A hotel employee loses his job and becomes uninsured, loses commercial insurance, then becomes uninsured, and who do they seek in terms of care under that scenario? Federally qualified health centers, public hospitals, the safety net. With healthcare reform, it's a much more fluid situation because any given individual, they could become insured by a employer, they could lose their job and become qualified for Medicaid just based upon income status. They could find another job, but that job doesn't offer health insurance, so then they have to purchase on the exchanges as a individual buyer. And then, of course, it figures in terms of how much income they make, whether they're going to get a subsidy. Now, this doesn't even account for people who are undocumented, which flow into the netherworld. And my good friend Kathy Coe has done a lot of work in terms of trying to understand the implications for that. as I think the people at the Asian Pacific Islander American Forum say, in the next, beyond 2014, the major filter with regards to whether you're going to get access to healthcare coverage is going to be dependent on your immigration status, whether you've been in the United States fewer than 5 years or whether you're undocumented. But nonetheless, to say that this particular slide suggests that we're dealing with individuals who are in a much fluid situation, it is conceivable that in a year, an individual could float from being commercially insured to getting into Medicaid under income eligibility and then going back because they found a new job and their income goes above Medicaid eligibility between 138 to 400% of federal poverty level and qualify for subsidies under the marketplace. So a very complex situation. Did I confuse you? Because if I confused you, how are our communities understanding this? And where is the opportunity for our communities to feel empowered into this process of getting insured? So these were some of the questions that actually came up as I mused with my IOM colleagues around this thing. I think it really boils down to a few questions. How much financial assistance do I qualify for? People want to know this if they're between 138% and 400% of the federal poverty level. How do I choose a plan? Most people have more understanding of car insurance than they do of health insurance, even though health insurance is much more profound in terms of its implications. What's the difference between tiers of coverage? When's the last time you talked to your average person on the street and says, do you have platinum coverage, do you have silver coverage, do you have copper coverage? It's very confusing. What happens if my financial situation changes? You probably notice in your financial pages of your newspaper, every week now there is a Q&A column with regards to people's financial situation and how it implicates or confounds their ability to get coverage. What sort of documentation do I need? Which is a huge issue because people are going to be required to show that they have certain income levels, when they got naturalized, whether they get coverage. When you fill out your tax return in 2014, you're going to have to show that you had coverage, so you better have the paperwork. And then all these complicated questions in English. What if you speak Spanish, or what if you speak Tagalog, what if you speak Cantonese? There are certain terms that we use freely in insurance language do not translate very well in different languages. The whole understanding of deductibles and co-payments is actually a fairly uniquely American kind of terminology because of our bizarre system of coverage. So I purposely kept kind of the colors a little pale here, but myself and a few of the other participants in the Institute of Medicine's roundtable on health literacy, notably Dr. Kavita Patel, who's at the Brookings Institute, Dr. Ruth Parker, who is at Emory University, and one of her colleagues, Dr. Victor Yu, who's going to be a White House fellow, who's a physician down at Emory. We actually mowed down, in terms of condensed down, what are the questions, four condensed questions that we believe every American should be able to get answers for. And the questions are, what are my choices for health insurance? How do I get it? How do I use it? And how much will it cost me? Right? So these are meant to be simple questions because my colleagues in the roundtable on health literacy, we have to have simple questions and simple answers. And why do we need this? It's because every person who's insured under the Affordable Care Act is entitled to know these answers. Okay. So what did we do? We started to put together the graphics and the messaging, at least for the navigators that are going to help people figure this out. And this is one graphic we use. And you chuckle about it. But, you know, I tried to look at the Boston Transit System map today, too. Okay, because we actually have to use these kinds of methods that people feel a little bit more comfortable with. I'm not saying that this is like the perfect way to graphically represent this, but we have to start to work with individuals and communities so they can understand that this is complex, but there is a pathway for coverage, there is a pathway for service, there's a pathway to feel secure in the kind of insurance coverage you're going to get. So as you can see here, we provided some examples of the different ways that people get coverage in the United States, and you know there's at least 10 to 12 ways that people get coverage in the United States. We show some of them here. And then how do you choose a primary care provider? How do you get specialty care? How do you get services whether you're acutely ill? How do you figure out what your pharmacy coverage is? These are the questions that we are expecting people to navigate. So before the Affordable Care Act was passed, we would ask people, do you think healthcare equity is going to change when everybody has a card in their pocket saying they're having health, they have health insurance? At least 95% of the people who live in the United States. Obviously, no. So it's not just a question of coverage, it's a question of using the services and also being knowledgeable, empowered consumers in the healthcare insurance situation because we have such a odd system of providing healthcare coverage. These are the critical issues that we feel need to be addressed when we look at minority communities and how they're going to get empowered on the Affordable Care Act. Outreach and community education regarding the expansion of Medicaid eligibility, and I believe Reverend Nancy and Alta will talk about that in just a second. Provide straightforward language. When's the last time you looked at the small lettering on your healthcare coverage? Straightforward language and assistance to individuals who wish to purchase insurance as individuals on the health insurance exchange. Assistance in understanding healthcare, i.e., quote, essential benefits. How to compare health plans. You know, what does it mean to have a narrow network, a broad network? What does it mean in terms of what hospital? How do I compare? When the marketplace was first set up, we said it's kind of like Travelocity. So I'm not sure if that analogy quite works anymore. But of course, people spend a lot more time figuring out, is this a hotel with a swimming pool, as opposed to whether I have enough copayment to pay for my medications. Make healthcare providers accountable in providing culturally competent and accessible care, and building a health system that's accountable regarding the persistence of healthcare disparities, the persistence of healthcare disparities. So myself and some colleagues put together this paper, which you can find at the Institute of Medicine website. It's called Amplifying the Voice of the Underserved in the Implementation of the Affordable Care Act. Too many words. I have to say, though, we wrote this paper after being inspired by the next two speakers, who I think you will find are the ones that are doing the work in our communities. And I'll tell you another secret story. Okay. So I was actually in a meeting with Kathy last week with Secretary Sebelius. It was an invited meeting. It was a closed meeting. And first thing, Secretary Sebelius says, well, has anyone been hearing anything about the marketplace recently? She said that sarcastically, of course, and people nervously chuckled. But it was very interesting because the people in that meeting were folks that were very much concerned about outreach to Asian Pacific Islander communities. And the whole story about technology and the web page, I have to say, that didn't consume our discussion because we never believed that a web page was going to be the basis in which people were going to entrust the government to be able to facilitate them getting coverage. So the story is not even 1% told with regards to what we need to do to reach out to communities. Technology is a component of it. It is not necessarily the decisive component when it comes to communities that have historically been cynical, skeptical about the ability of government and bureaucracies to look at the needs of the community. We need heroines like the next two speakers who really do that work. So this, you know, we're not even at the first yard line. Okay, we have a lot to do with regards to what is going to be done with our communities. Our conclusions at this paper have to do with these few points, and I'm just going to paraphrase what they say. We need aggressive, creative, and widespread dissemination of community-created messages. So each of you, potentially, really could be a messenger. And people are going to say, I heard this web page is all screwed up. That's not the message that we need to tell. It's about communities having some investment in the success of getting covered. Messaging to communities should not only address how to obtain healthcare coverage, but also should educate people about being responsible, informed, and empowered healthcare consumers. That's key, because people who are not informed are more likely to use the system wrong or not get the care they need. Community-based organizations that are awarded contracts to conduct community outreach efforts should be grassroots-oriented. Goes without saying. The needs of limited English-speaking communities in being informed about the opportunities of the Affordable Care Act should be engineered into the core of outreach. Limited English. And why do I say that? When we talk about equity, we should start as a foundational piece of whatever we do with regards to healthcare coverage, healthcare access. Equity is the basis in which we understand success. It's not the add-on after we got other things right. And levels of trust and confidence among new consumers of healthcare coverage should be evaluated. We need evaluation. And I think that in a year or two, the evaluation is, yeah, we heard about the glitch, we're used to that. But I really was able to get the kind of coverage I needed because I went to people that I trusted. But we need that measure and that evaluation. So all this material you can find on the Institute of Medicine webpage. If you put in healthcare reform, you look specifically under the IOM Roundtable on Health Disparities, the IOM Roundtable on Health Literacy, and you can see some of the work that we've been doing. And thank you very much.